You have to be able to sing to work here. Coincidentally, the poem that I have chosen for some opening words is a close translation of what Donna sang to you in Sanskrit. It's an ancient Sanskrit salutation to the dawn. Look to this day, for it is life, the very life of life. In its brief course lie all the verities and realities of our existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of beauty. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well spent, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of hope. Look well, therefore, to this day. It is good to be together again. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. A place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Story that has been one of my favorites ever since I heard it. I don't know whether you've heard it before, but if you have, it's worth hearing again, and if you haven't, it's certainly worth hearing for a first time. I think the story came from some American Indian tribes. At least the version that I read came from there. It was about a young boy, about the age of most of you, and one of his friends had done something to him that made him angry. One of his friends had cheated him out of something. It made him very angry, and the boy wanted to get even with his friend. And so he planned all kinds of horrible things he could do to get even with his friend for making him angry. And then before he set out to do these horrible things that he'd planned, he thought about it, and he wondered if he'd really be happy with himself after he'd been just as awful to his friend as his friend had been to him. So when he was stuck like this, he did what he often did, and he went to his grandfather, because he thought his grandfather was very wise, and at any rate, his grandfather was very old, and he'd been around a long time. He went to his grandfather, and he told him his problem. And he told him what his friend had done to him, that it was awful, and that he had these wonderful plans to really get even with his friend. And then he said, "But you know, sometimes, grandfather, I'm not sure that's what I want to do. Sometimes I think maybe that's not the best thing to do, and I'm confused, and I don't know what to do. So I want your advice." And the grandfather listened to all this, and he nodded. He said, This is very similar. He said, "I've thought things like this so many times." He said, "My whole life," he said, "I've thought this." And he said, "It's as though inside of me there were two wolves fighting to control me. And one was a very kind wolf that always wants me to do kind and loving things to other people. And the other is a very angry wolf. And it fights to control me and always wants to get even and do horrible things to people." And he said, "My entire life, those wolves have been fighting inside of me to control me." And then the grandfather stopped. And this didn't help the boy a bit. And he sat there for a while waiting for more. And there wasn't more. And he said, "Grandfather, I don't understand. Which wolf wins?" The grandfather nodded slowly to him, and he said, "Ah," he said, "the wolf that wins is the one that I choose to feed." That's the whole story. This Wednesday night at 7, we will have a memorial service here for all the innocent victims of September 11th. It will have stories done by some storytellers from many world traditions, and music, and some ritual, and I invite you to come to it. During this time of centering, when we take time to sit quietly or to light candles of memory and hope, sometimes we have quiet music playing in the background, sometimes we have silence playing in the background. This morning, we have filled one of these baskets with many, many stones. I didn't count them, but they're stones meant to symbolize The roughly 8,000 lives, by one count, that were lost on last September 11th, 3,000 in this country, and perhaps 5,000 in our retaliatory bombing of Afghanistan. They're just stones. But this morning, they're stones with stories. 8,000 of them. This morning, as we light our candles of memory and hope, we can do it against the background of falling stones. Of unimaginable crimes against each other. We are capable of slaughtering our brothers and sisters with great self-righteousness, as though they were not humans, but merely stones. Let us confess that the ability to hate comes from as ancient a place as the ability to love, that the ability to destroy is as deeply human as the ability to create. Who are we when we cheer the destruction of innocent people? What drives us so often to seek revenge as a first response rather than more reasoned and less bloody tactics? We can be so tender toward our own children, our own mates, our own parents, yet so easily callous toward the children, mates, and parents of others. We come fully equipped to do both good and evil, to love and to hate, to be blessings or curses to the world. How can we engender our tender mercies and protect them against our furies? Let us give power and courage to those tender mercies that we may help turn the tide of our world. As St. Francis of Assisi prayed, where there is hatred, let us sow love. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is error, truth. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is sadness, joy. Where there is darkness, light. Let us not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, in forgiving that we are forgiven, and in dying to hate that we are born into love. Let us become the noble people we are meant to be, for the world needs us at our most humane. Let it be so here, now. Let it be so. Amen. I often draw from stories from religions and cultures all over the world, and I think I'm probably more comfortable drawing from foreign stories than from more familiar stories. And I've decided this year to try to draw from some more familiar stories, from some stories from the Bible, and approach them with the same kind of openness that I can approach stories from other cultures for. I decided to begin at the beginning by taking one single part of one simple story from the book of Genesis and then doing something unusual with it by combining it with a story from another tradition. It's the part in Genesis that you all heard, whether you've read your Bible this week or not, or this year. The part where Adam and Eve were placed in what some have called a fool's paradise and told that they could stay there as long as they never learned the difference between good and evil. They never ate from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And of course, we're a curious species. And they did. And they were thrown out of paradise and from then on had to live east of Eden. A couple chapters later, after the story of Cain and Abel, they also had to live, Cain had to live east of Eden, and it was called the land of Nod, which means the land of wandering or restlessness. The first thing we need to remember about this story from Genesis is that it was not written as an eyewitness account. It was a story written 25 or 30 centuries ago to try to put a kind of an imaginative twist on the world we're living in and what it's made of and why it's not as simple as the picture of paradise. Whoever made up the story is saying the one difference between us and the other animals is that we know about good and evil, and that makes a difference. It's also saying that the price of growing up is that it expels us from a fool's paradise where nobody knew about good and evil. On a little deeper level, it's also admitting that we know both of them, good and evil. And it says that knowing the difference between good and evil is a measure of what's noble about us. After all, it was the food reserved for the gods in the old myth. So we live east of Eden in the land of Nod, trying to make it through the world, armed with our human nature and this strange and troubling knowledge of good and evil. And ever since then, we've been trying to figure out which is which and what it means. Now, I want to combine that story with a very different kind. It's a Turkish folk tale. It's been a favorite story of mine and one of the most disturbing religious stories I've ever read, ever since I first stumbled across it 11 years ago. It's a story about justice. Four boys in this story were close friends. They cared a lot for each other. They did everything together. They shared equally in all things that they did. They also loved walnuts. And one year when the walnuts were in season, they went to the lone walnut tree in their town, and they spent the afternoon hunting and finding all of the walnuts that had fallen from the tree and putting them in a basket so that they could share them equally later. But when they counted the walnuts from the basket, they found that there were 83. And that doesn't divide by four. They looked in vain for an 84th walnut, but if there had been an 84th walnut, there wouldn't be a story. And so they have four boys and 83 walnuts, and the best they could figure out how to do is give three boys 21 and one 20. But that wasn't just enough. So they went to see their Hoja, their local holy man, and they told him their problem. And he said, why have you come to me? And they said, we want justice, Hoja, and we want your advice on what the just thing to do is. And he said, oh, you're asking a much bigger question than you know. He said, I need to know first, what kind of justice do you want? Do you want God's justice or human justice? Well, they hadn't thought about it this way. They went back to talk it over. They weren't sure what either one was, but they could certainly think of some examples of human justice gone awry. They knew stories of judges who'd been bribed. They knew stories of legal cases that had not been decided fairly. And they told each other several of these stories and then decided that they knew now what they wanted. They went back to the Hoja and they said, we've decided unanimously that it's God's justice we want, not human justice. You're sure? He said. This can't be undone. We're sure, he said. Very well. The Hoja took the basket of walnuts, and to the first boy he gave 70, to the second boy he gave 10, to the third boy he gave 3, and to the fourth, none at all. When I first started the story, I didn't even want to finish it because I was sure I knew how it would end. I was surprised, as you may have been too. It sounds almost blasphemous to think that God's justice is so unfair and that fairness might come only through human justice. Then I remembered stories in the Bible, and you can find them in so many religious scriptures, the number of times that God tells His people to slaughter the thousands of innocent men, women, and children in a neighboring village, to leave no man or beast alive. The number of times that it seems that the kind of justice that God exacts is a justice that rewards the powerful and annihilates the weak. And that's disturbing. And in the real world, in history, it's the same as it is in the scriptures. With the anniversary of September 11th coming up, we're all being trained to think of that attack on our Pentagon and our World Trade Center, where perhaps 3,000 innocent people were killed. It's fair to think of that attack. And we also have to think of our retaliatory attacks against the desperately poor country of Afghanistan, where we may have killed perhaps 5,000 people who were also innocent and who had nothing to do with the attack on our country. One embarrassing minister a month or so ago gained 15 minutes of infamy by talking about Islam and how Islam is a horrible, murderous religion, and that no Christian would ever be told to kill innocent people. It's a man who obviously doesn't know any history at all. And so we remember back 7 centuries to the Christian Crusades, when, just like the Muslim extremists, Christians were told by the church to go forth and slaughter thousands of innocent Muslims, and were told that they would be rewarded with an eternity in heaven if they were killed in battle. Is this God's justice? The rule of the strong? The annihilation of the weak? The numbers are staggering. Here in this basket, we have maybe 8,000 stones. If we were to have baskets to symbolize the Americans who were killed in the Vietnam War, we'd need 7.5 baskets like that, full of stones. If our hearts expanded to include the 1 million Vietnamese who were probably killed in the war that they call the American War, it would take 125 baskets full of stones. I don't know what God the Cambodian dictator Pol Pot talked with, but it would take 500 of these stone-filled baskets to count the 4 million of his own people that he murdered. So if God is the preeminent force in the world, then these things seem to be God's justice, and the Turkish story seems to be right. They certainly seem to be the law of the world, the way things run on. It's a powerful form of justice, and it's ingrained in every one of us, but it's an odd form of justice. It's a justice completely devoid of compassion. Meanwhile, the voices of millions of people are crying out for a different kind of justice. Who will listen to them, and where will it come from? Because as we have eaten from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we seem to know them both. And this God's justice business seems to be absolutely hardwired in us. You can think of 100 examples from your own lives of this kind of justice that you don't even blink at. The most attractive young men and women have the largest number of choices for mates. The most popular, outgoing, charismatic, and athletic have far more choices than the rest. In all of our sports, in all of our athletic contests, only the winner counts. Though with our computers we can count figures so large we can't even count how many digits they have. When we're counting in sports, we can only count to one. Football fans all cheer for their team to be number one. You never see a stadium of football fans shouting, "We're number three." This is a species-specific trait. We watch the Survivor shows on television, if you watch them. And again, everyone takes it for granted. Of course only one person's going to win. 83 walnuts to the winner, nuts to the losers. And we accept this as a kind of justice. It's that deep inside of us. I remember a few years ago when it was disclosed that Michael Jordan had been paid $25 million in a promotional fee by Nike for promoting their tennis shoes. And someone pointed out that if you add up all of the Asian workers in all of the tennis shoe companies that make our tennis shoes, Nike, Reebok, and the rest of them, it's about 20,000 workers who work for an average wage of $500 a year, which means that Michael Jordan alone made more than twice as much as the entire Asian labor force combined. No one picketed any of his games. Something in us can say, well, he's Michael Jordan. That's fair. We know this kind of justice. We know it well. Something inside of us resonates with this. It's the same kind of thinking that makes us shrug off the fact that Bill Gates now has more money, controls more money than 100 million Americans. Now, if you were doing this as stones, if the people were stones, we would need 12,500 baskets like that, with 8 stones each. And then you would put 12,500 baskets of stones on one end of the scale, and one stone, or Bill Gates, on the other end of the scale, and they'd be equal. And we accept it. God's justice. It's the way of the world. It's a justice that favors combat over compassion, competition over cooperation. It's a justice that only remembers the winners, the few, while the many are forgotten as unimportant, almost invisible. God's justice. Sure, there are cries of the poor, the starving, the powerless, cries for food, for mercy, for life. Mostly they go unheeded. Mostly we don't do much about them. This is the lens through which I've been looking at our country and our world this week, from combining the story from Genesis and that very troubling Turkish folktale about the difference between God's justice and human justice, a story which never did tell us what human justice was. And if you look at the world this way, it puts very clear patterns to some things that I've spoken of in other ways, and I want to share some with you. I've talked before here, and will certainly talk again, to the delight of some of you and the consternation of others, about our economic picture in our country and how it's been so dramatically changed over the past 20 years or so to favor the very wealthy at the expense of nearly everyone else. But now I want to look at this as an example of God's justice, as the way the world works, the way the real world works, living east of Eden. The restructuring of our economy has not been subtle, but it's been very rapid. I'll give you just a few figures, but I want you to hear these as examples of God's justice. Between 1981 and 1986, the income tax on America's wealthiest people was reduced from 70% to 28% in 5 years. 20 years earlier, it had been 91%. Taxes on corporations have fallen as dramatically. Some large corporations now pay almost nothing in taxes, which means all of that money that's needed has to come from other parts of the society that are less wealthy. This has something to do with the fact that income taxes on workers in our country have increased fivefold in the last 50 years, from about 5% to about 25%. During the decade of the 1980s, the Reagan years, the portion of our nation's wealth held by the top 1% nearly doubled from 22% to 39%, probably the most rapid escalation in U.S. history. For the past 20 years, the American economy has been identified primarily with the activity of the stock market. But of the stock market gains of the 1990s, 86% went to the top 10% of households, and even that's terribly misleading, because almost half of that, 42%, went to the top 1%. 70 walnuts, 10, 3, and nothing. It's the same kind of justice that the Turkish folktale identified as God's justice. It's the same kind of justice that makes us accept without blinking when Michael Jordan makes twice as much as an entire workforce of 20,000 Asians in a year, or when Bill Gates is worth more than 100 million of us. In a way, this gives a kind of dignity to this sort of justice. It's everywhere. It seems to be the way the world has always worked. It seems to be part of the plan of nature, and we seem to accept it without a whimper. The man who wrote the book, the main book that I've read on this, is a man named Kevin Phillips, who's been writing on wealth and democracy, which is the name of his newest book. He's been writing on it for several decades. He's a Republican. And he's very clear that this is not partisan politics. He reminds us that in 1972, Richard Nixon's Republican platform actually criticized multinational corporations for building plants overseas to take advantage of cheap labor. That was the Republicans who criticized that 30 years ago. Since 1980, all four presidents, three Republicans and a Democrat, have helped restructure the economy to transfer money, power, and possibilities from the low and the middle to the very top. He reminds us that NAFTA was enacted by Bill Clinton, a Democrat, with its provision in its Chapter 11 that lets investors bring claims against the governments of Canada, the United States, and Mexico to demand compensation if national laws cost them profits. For example, by forbidding them to import unsafe products. One ruling against the United States required us to amend our Clean Air Act to permit the entry of Venezuelan gasoline that did not meet federal standards. Oddly, that story was not carried on page one. And the World Trade Organization, whose headquarters used to be in the World Trade Center, brings similar suits against governments that impede profits. Suits that are decided by three member panels that are not answerable to the court system of any country in the world, including ours. Thailand, for example, was told to give up manufacturing a cheap AIDS drug after the U.S. threatened a suit on behalf of an American pharmaceutical firm, which was losing money. Critics of the new laws have pointed out the potential dangers of a worldwide policy of formally putting profits ahead of people. They said, for instance, that each year Japan, the European Union, and Canada have been publishing lists of American laws that they consider harmful to their profits and therefore illegal. In 1999, they identified 95 such laws in California alone. This is God's justice. This is the way of the world. Just as surely as the bombing of innocent countries and the subjugation of powerless people, whether from Old Testament stories or modern history, is God's justice. If one is just, the other must be just. Does this mean that this is simply the way the real world has to work in the grown-up world? This is what it takes to be number one? That doesn't seem to be true. During the 1980s and 90s, for example, wages in our country lost ground while the number of hours worked increased. As many of you know quite personally, And yet during the same time, in Britain, France, Germany, and Japan, wages rose while the number of hours worked decreased. By 2000, the United States had the highest levels of economic inequality of all major industrial nations. The author wrote this sentence, which I stumbled over when I read, and still stumble over, and I pass on to you to stumble over and to think about. Today, he says, a CEO would be embarrassed to admit he sacrificed profits to protect employees or a community. I think that's true. I can even imagine the defenses that would be offered of it. The stockholders would revolt if I didn't. I'd be fired. Someone else would take over as CEO. We now have the highest percentage of poverty in people over the age of 65 among the industrialized nations. We have the highest percentage of child poverty among those nations. We have the lowest percentage of students finishing high school. And we have the highest rates of youth homicides. Some of these figures may be news to you, but the overall picture can't be. We've been living in this brave new world over the last 20 or 30 years. The part that interests me comes through thinking of all these conditions that I don't like as examples of God's justice. Not any worse than the other examples of it found in the Bible, in other religious scriptures, and throughout human history. It is the way of the world. Yet it's terribly ironic. We were driven out of paradise, according to the old story, because supposedly we learned the difference between good and evil. The God who expelled us in that old story is on record in the Bible as sanctioning the slaughter of thousands of innocents, including his own, when he nearly destroyed the whole world. So the Turkish folktale seems to be right. What are the other kind of justice? What's human justice? In the Bible, the voices pleading for human justice don't come from God, they come from the prophets. Amos sees the ancient equivalent of our Asian tennis shoe sweatshops, and Amos has a fit. He says God is angry because the people of his time sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, that they trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth. But it wasn't God saying that. It was Amos demanding human justice to correct the justice the world offers. The same was true of Jesus. He saw the way the world has always worked, what the Turkish story calls God's justice. And he called for a new way of living. He said, whatever we do to the least of these, we do also to God. That is certainly not the ethic driving CEOs of corporations today, at least successful corporations. Jesus also attributed these commandments to God, but history shows otherwise. It was the vision of Jesus. You know, the closest those four boys were ever going to come to justice was if they had done it themselves. If they divided the walnuts and given three boys 21 and one boy 20 and promised to make it up to them the next time. And they could have done it because they cared for one another. Their justice was not based on unequal power. It was based on equal compassion. That's human justice. It isn't based on market value or military might or concerned with which handful of people can dominate the rest. Isn't it ironic to think of human justice as based on love, and that it is the only hope we have to escape God's justice, which always seems to be based on the law of might makes right? That's ironic. Throughout our history, in the midst of this world east of Eden, the only chance we've ever had to create a just world has been through the application not of the laws of nature, not of the laws of God, but of the rules of human justice that have come through our prophets, our poets, our artists, sometimes our politicians, our leaders. Only humans can do that. And only if they will, only if they'll remember the difference between the two kinds of justice, the difference between good and evil, and remember to fight for the compassionate kind against the kind that favors power. You may wonder why I chose to preach this sermon now. There were two reasons. One is that the anniversary of September 11th is coming up Wednesday, and most of the voices we're hearing from our leaders and our media are demanding God's justice from the angry God that they have ordered to bless America. We can't let that be the only voice we hear. We must be reminded that there is a higher calling than the trumpet of war. I thought we learned in my war, in Vietnam, that when you bomb and destroy thousands of innocent people, you do not win their hearts and their minds. You just create more people who will hate you. The other reason for giving this sermon now was because we were talking about our pledge campaign and support for the church. This may not seem related, but it is. It's like the children's story of the old grandfather who talked about the two wolves inside of him fighting for control. The compassionate wolf, which wanted him to do good. The angry wolf, which wanted him to do bad. And he said that the wolf that wins is the one that he feeds. I'm not sure that the image of a wolf is quite what I want for the church. Maybe instead it's more like the angels of our better nature and the angels of our lower nature. We left the garden with the knowledge of both good and evil and the capacity for both. The word angel in the Old Testament meant messenger. And we have those angels and those voices around us. There are the angels of our lower nature who will reward power with power and consign the weak to the dustbins of history. And the voices are everywhere. And there are also the angels of our better nature urging us to a higher concept of justice based in compassion and love, rather than power and vengeance. The ones that win are the ones that we choose to feed. I'll promise that I will help this church and the leaders of this church make this a haven for the angels of our better nature, a place where the voices of compassion and inclusion can be nurtured, and where we will listen to the cries for a more humane and a more just world. I'll promise that this will be a home for the angels of our better nature. But these angels, like other angels, need to be fed. And the ones that we feed will win. And the more and the better that you feed us, the more likely it is that we will all win. That's my absolute belief and my humble prayer. Amen.